Hello everyone, Chris here. I haven't scripted this intro, so I'll have to see if I can fly by the seat of my pants. Why do people say that? I have no idea. Let's hit up Google and find out. Not right now, though. This is an audio apology, and it's an apology, about the audio. It's on behalf of Illyrio, who, midway through the recording, and you'll spot the moment, realises he was recording on the microphone he didn't want to be. And so his audio is not as great this week. As you know, he normally sounds utterly perfect and brilliant in all ways. This week, there's a very hard gate on it. So when he's not speaking, he'll cut into instant silence. And also, there's a sort of a high-pitched fan in the background. I've tried to have a go at it, but I can't take those frequencies out, sadly. However, if it helps make it more exciting, firstly, I'm going to put a fan on in the background. In solidarity, I'll try and make it as loud as possible. Oh God, that's powerful. If it helps make it more exciting, maybe imagine that he's not at home, but he's calling in on some kind of, you know, citizens band radio or some kind of, you know, online facility. Which, well, I mean, that's exactly what's going on, but from further afield, like Basra or Mars. Anyway, so all glory to the Space Illyrio, and I'm going to turn this fan back off again because it's too noisy. And enjoy the Last Word podcast. Let's start recording now. I'm going to start recording, and I'm going to match up with the recordings you guys are already doing.
Okay.
And I'm just going to start again.
Sure.
It means we lose the Iwata chat. Sorry about that. That's entirely my fault. So we're just going to go straight on.
May I recommend a closing song that would be Nintendo inspired?
Go.
No, I don't have one on hand, but I'm just making that as a suggestion.
Right. So you want a closing song for Money, Love, and Birdseed that is Nintendo inspired and works with the episode?
Absolutely.
Right. Thanks for that, Illyrio, and welcome everyone to the Last Word podcast with Chris and Illyrio. That's the Illyrio.
Hey.
I'm the Chris, and we got a third one today. Who are you?
I am Paul Mackey. I am in the twin ports of Duluth, Minnesota, and Superior, Wisconsin.
Hey.
At the foot of the Bong Bridge.
Nice.
It doesn't look like a bong, it's just called that, et cetera, et cetera. I've said this on many podcasts.
And lo and behold, you have already said it on this podcast in a section that I screwed up because I wasn't recording. I'm always happy to, to let people know when I've done wrong.
Well, that's why I breezed through it. Like I said, I've said it on a few podcasts.
Yeah,
Potentialcast, I believe.
It was highly professional.
Indeed.
It was a superior intro.
Agreed.
And it wasn't at all dull, Luth.
Nope.
Fucking hell. Right, yeah. We know that you like the UK and Canada because it came up earlier. I won't make everyone remember and restate everything I said. I'm just going to get into it. Are you right for this with the money, love, and birdseed, not money, mummy loving the birdseed, as some heard me say, episode?
Yes, let's go.
Let's do this!
Let's do this, like Minnesota's own Brock Lesnar. Paul, what do you think of the theme tune to Press Gang?
The theme tune to Press Gang, I think, definitely sounds newsroomy.
It does. And if you're unsure how it can sound newsroomy, listen to this. There you go. As you may have guessed, we don't play stuff in live.
I see.
All right, here
Neither
we are.
Do I.
Nah. Right, here we are for Money, Love, and Birdseed. Now, Illyrio, you might remember that last week, or
yes,
last time we said, I said this episode featured someone with amazing shoulders.
Yes.
Wrong episode. That is, in fact, an episode from Season 2 called Love and the Junior Gazette. I apologise.
All right, it's okay.
So if you were looking for shoulders throughout this entire thing, and I guess you weren't, you'd have been disappointed. Except for Bobby Tweed, of course, who has a...
I may have been looking for shoulders subconsciously.
That's true. All right, we're directed by Lorne McGorry. It's Monday, 20th of March, 1989. Paul, how old are you at this point?
At that point, I would be 17.
Wow. Yeah, you were...
Wait, 16.
So you'd have been at the point where you almost weren't interested in watching Press Gang anyway.
Oh, hang on. 15 coming up on 16.
That's much more like it. Good age. Good Press Gang.
Paul gets younger
age.
And younger as he talks.
He's like he's like the inverse of Colin Matthews' pricing strategy.
Yes.
I've enjoyed that on the artwork for last week, a steal at only £7.
Yep. Loved
the
it.
Top corner.
It Thank was great. You. It was fantastic.
Right. The blurb on the back, it say, how come the newsroom is full of pigeons and Colin's hiding under an umbrella? Mystery surrounds the disappearance of £30 from the school judo club, but Bobby Tweed protests his innocence. And love? Tiddler has a plan to get Spike and Linda together, but will it work? So, I'm guessing if you don't deal with pounds as a monetary value, this sounds really weird every so often. It's like, I've lost £30. Go, wow, that's amazing.
Good for you.
Yeah.
it sounds like a fair amount of cash.
It certainly is, particularly at the time. Like, the notion that there are kids walking around with like over a tenner in their pockets at school in 1989 is really odd to me.
Mm-hmm.
The equivalent is almost double that at the moment, I think.
Well, and at the time, it would be more impressive.
Yeah, well, I'd say it was a time when I'm going to point this out later, but some of the kids in the judo class had like 20p, which covered their bus fare home. And I remember the junior bus fare going from 15 to 20 pence. And that was astonishing. And that takes me back. Right. The reason I'm stalling for time, Illyrio, is because I'm going for my clock.
Oh, yes.
Which I do when I hear the word culture. sorry. Because now you... oh, no, sorry. Hang on a second. I've put all of our names on the clicker. Click. Oh, it's Illyrio. Illyrio, you're going to be...
good.
Because it's always Illyrio. Even if we have a guest, I'm always making him do this.
Yep.
Illyrio, you're going to summarize the episode in 60 seconds or less. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Cool, go.
Okay. This is an episode full of sleuthing, full of recreation, full of gotcha moments, and full of Billy holding out a really important information that could have saved everyone a lot of time. There are birds pooping everywhere. There's obviously a couple of dreams that are pointing directly to the fact that Linda and Spike are maybe going to be an item. Tids gets in there and tries to play matchmaker and really just turns the whole situation into something a little less than ideal. It kind of backfires in the end. Billy and Sarah are diametrically opposed as to whether or not this kid stole the money. And yeah, there's a kid who was accused of stealing money, but it turns out that Keith disappoints us all! Keith! No! It was Jerry's idea, is really what happened. And I think that's the end.
Ooh, that's not bad. How do you think you did?
A little bit over?
No, that is 55.28 seconds.
Oh, I had a lot more time to actually talk about what happened.
That's true. However, your disappointment in Keith matches the tone of quite a lot of my later synopsis. Damn you, Keith.
Damn you, Keith.
Yeah, on Ramjack scoring, you were 0.28 away from Chump.
Yeah.
I know.
You avoided Chumpness. Chumpitude.
Chumpitude.
So, No, that's Alex's job. I'm not going to do the thing. And also, you weren't a chump, so there's no need.
I don't think I've ever been a chump.
Nah, you are chump free. You've gone over a number of times. But that's all right. Okay, Paul, here I basically do a one-man performance of the episode. Interrupt me as much as you can and do it frequently. Otherwise, that is all people are going to get, is me doing the episode, which they should have just watched the episode. Are you ready? Also, it might be handy to have the episode available to you in a tab at this point, because sometimes I might say, hey, have a look at this in the background. Is that going to be a problem for anyone?
I'm getting it up right now.
I see.
Hey-o!
I wasn't going to say it, but at one point I'm going to have to find out what Money Love Nigerian movie is, because I've been typing Money Love Birdseed to get the episode. And the autocompletes are Money Love Nigerian Movie, Money Love Song, Money Love 2 Nigerian Movie. Really? So it's a franchise.
Money Love 2.
Yeah.
Let's see, it's playing through the ad. There we go. Okay.
There was an ad?
Cool. Oh, but it's YouTube. It's YouTube, it does ads.
Well, indeed. My one doesn't. But I'm going to mute it as well. The first one I'm going to mention, Illyrio, this is for you.
Yeah.
I say run the opening titles to about 17 seconds and look what happens on the left-hand side of the screen. Please play along at home.
Yes, indeed.
If you run to 16 seconds, you'll see Sarah looking at a piece of paper.
Yeah.
Now, if you press play and just wait for a freeze frame, who's that in the background?
It's coming up. There he is!
It's Mystery School Uniform Human.
School Uniform Human.
He is forever haunting the background of Keldar Holmes.
A voice for today's youth.
Yes. She is a voice for today's youth. Right. Right, we're on.
I'm going to interrupt you right away.
Go.
I need to talk about the incidental music.
Yes.
For this episode.
Yes.
Flute and beatboxing.
Flute and beatboxing right at the beginning, and then lots and lots of bass.
Yes.
Throughout the episode. The music is fantastic.
The music is weird in this
one. It's great. I loved it. I thought it was great.
That's cool. I have a kind of a love-hate relationship with the music to Press Gang, like I do with the music to The X-Files.
Mm-hmm.
Like, when Mark Snow hits it, he's spot on, but when he doesn't, God, he's distracting.
Yeah. And am I the only one who thought that this was Stephen Moffat chasing after a blonde kid?
It's because he's a white man with an afro, right?
He's a white man with an afro. And I know that you told me it was the only time we'd see him would be in that previous episode, but I was like, is this Moffat?
I can see what you mean. Now I've got him sort of in blurry, in shadows.
Mm-hmm.
Also, like, coming out of the changing room, by the way, and not the gym, which doesn't work with the story, but never mind. let's get ahead of ourselves.
Because I had no idea what this was, and please remind me of the suspected hoodlum's name.
Bobby Tweed.
Bobby Tweed, as he's running out and about to go up the stairs, I'm fixated on his zipper because it looks like it's open.
Oh,
and wow. So this was leading me to kind of suspect all kinds of strange things. What are they? Is this some kind of? Is he running away from an abuser? What's going on? And then it's just about money.
Oh, you're right. He does seem to have come adrift there.
Yeah, it does look like that, doesn't it?
I have never noticed that.
Yeah.
Oh, crumbs!
My eyes went right there.
Yeah, so Bobby Tweed, I don't know about you, but when I hear that name, I think of a kind of prototypical late 50s rock and roll star.
Nice.
Like, if I'd never heard Runaway by Del Shannon, and you played me it and went, that was Bobby Tweed and the Tweed Tones there, I'd have no reason not to believe you.
Exactly.
There you go. But instead of that, we get a big blonde chap in a very colourful tracksuit jacket and jeans being chased by a PE teacher. You may say gym teacher where you're from. I'm just going to call him Mr. Prescott, which is his name.
Mr. Prescott.
And there you go.
By the way, Mr. Prescott is my locksmith.
Is he?
Yes.
I like that you've got a locksmith.
We do, because my wife in particular is in charge of a couple of rental units here in town, and sometimes people lose their keys or forget their keys. Sometimes we need to change the locks and people abscond.
Mm.
And so we have a guy who's fantastic. His name is Monsieur Prescott, and he is 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. He's available.
Nice.
Yes, so if you're looking for a locksmith in my part of the world, just look for him.
Yeah, not very convenient for me.
No, sorry.
Bit of a drive, bit of a swim.
Drive and swim. You can hop on a jet ski, according to people.
That's fair enough. Right, yeah, so I'm still getting over the crazy music in this scene. It's like, boom, boom.
It's great. I'm trying to get over the next scene, but I'm going to wait for you.
All right. Well, at the newsroom, and not back at the newsroom yet, just at the newsroom this time. Mm-hmm. We've got plenty of time to come back to the newsroom. Spike and Linda enter mid-argument. Spike tells
me. No, actually, what they enter is Garfield Town.
There's a lot of Garfield about. Julia Sawalha quite liked Garfields. She brought one in, put it on the desk, and someone, set dresser or Lorne McGorry, has kind of highlighted the dream sequence nature of this by upping the amount of Garfield.
Yeah. The Garfield in the graduation cap is my favorite Garfield.
Nice. There's another detail in a later dream sequence, mm-hmm. which I bet you spotted.
But we'll see.
But yeah, they do enter Garfield Town mid-argument, run by President James Garfield. And he didn't respond on Mondays, which I think is a joke from Bloom County now I come I to think it of it. We had a whole discussion about Burke Breathed's Bloom County earlier, which is now lost to the mist of time because of me. Two-thirds of the conversation remain, but my bit doesn't. And that's the only bit that matters. Sorry, I'm trying to be self-aggrandizing.
Thanks for being honest, Chris.
But it doesn't work because I'm a twat. Anyway, Spike and Linda enter mid-argument. Spike tells Linda that subconsciously she wants to go out with them. She's amazed. Even knows the word subconsciously, which frankly is doing him a disservice even by our own standards.
Agreed.
He claims to have read it in Batman Goes to the Psychiatrist.
That is such a great title.
It is. Not least because I'm sure that if he doesn't go to a psychiatrist, he probably does need to occasionally.
It might be possible.
And it may actually be a central point to the Batman versus Superman movie coming out next year.
Nice. He goes to the superchiatrist.
Ooh. Rather than the subchiatrist?
Yes, correct. The subchiatrist lives underground and drives a big tunnel boring machine.
Tunnel boring machine.
TBM for life. Mm-hmm. And we're a strange set of people.
Although I think the tunnel boring machine type psychiatrist is probably a character on The Tick.
Perhaps
seems
so.
A more appropriate spot for that character. And we find out that in fact...
As often happens now with these Spike and Linda barbed flirting sessions, I don't write anything down because it's just too much, too fast.
I did put down that she does invite him to feel her braille.
Yes.
Yeah, and read her semaphore.
Mm. I'm amazed Spike didn't, for want of a better word, like rise to the bait of feeling the braille. That seems exactly the sort of thing he would respond to. But never mind. Spike gets back onto the subject of Linda fancying him on a subconscious level, claiming that he can prove that she dreams about him. She asks him how. He clicks his fingers and Linda wakes up in bed at home, which is hilarious. She says,
and
damn.
Damn. That's a really great damn. That's really awesome.
Because you can say damn on kids' programs in the UK.
True.
Because no one cares. Oh, there you go. She takes this, however, as confirmation that Spike definitely wouldn't know the word subconsciously, which again is a pretty harsh assessment.
Yeah, agreed.
Linda's mother, seen here for the first time, and is a much...
Paul! Paul! Mm. Yes. Who does Linda's mother remind you of?
Don't know. I'm sorry.
I immediately went to, and now I've lost my tab. Hold on, everyone. I immediately went to Maud...
From Harold and Maude?
No. From the American situational comedy starring B. Arthur.
Golden Girls?
No, Maude was before then. It is fantastic. Is it Adrienne Barbeau?
Oh, wow. Oh, okay. If you say Adrienne Barbeau, then I know exactly who you mean.
Yeah. Anyway. So Adrienne Barbeau played Maude's daughter. Grown-up daughter on Maude and was living at home or had to return home. Maude is an excellent situational comedy. If you haven't watched it or haven't heard of it, please find parts of it or entireties of it online somehow and watch because it is really great. It was really just a wonderful vehicle for a very strong... feminist character in Maude, played by Bea Arthur, before her Golden Girls days, and really, really, really fantastic show.
And now I've got an image search going on for Adrienne Barbeau, and I'm gonna name her Best Dressed, despite
agreed,
not being
right?
in the episode. Right. Anyway, Linda's mother turns out to be a much nicer character than you might have come to expect, and funnily enough, is played by a woman called Penelope Nice.
No.
Yes, that's true.
That's fantastic.
Check her out in the end credits. You can't always just trust the end credits, as you'll find out in season 3 when someone gets a very, very amusing name misspelling, I believe twice in two episodes. But there you go. Right, she pops in and tells Linda there's a boy downstairs to see her. We find out it's Saturday as well. The boy didn't give a name, he was very insistent. Oh, that Spike. So she gets out of bed in her teddy bear pyjamas and tries to make herself less appealing with her longest dressing gown and by making her hair look tousled, a tactic which entirely fails to make her look bad.
Agreed.
And to the sound of a trilling cymbal, because the music continues to be insane, she barges off to confront Spike, only to find out that he's Bobby Tweed.
Yeah. Which is really... I thought it was going to be Spike.
Yeah. That's good, isn't it? Good misdirection.
Very good. Very, very excellent misdirection.
Nice. Back at the newsroom. Take a drink. There's a pigeon issue. Little Nazis.
Pigeon ha-ha.
Pigeon ha-ha.
Pigeon ha-ha.
Now, my friend Cynthia in Toronto, when I was in Toronto with her at one point, called the pigeons shit eagles.
Interesting.
Which I was like, I'm not jingoistic American, but what would you think if I called rats turd beavers?
I don't know.
I'd be fine with that.
Yeah, all good. I call national
symbol games.
Funnily enough, I call pigeons flying rats.
Yeah,
they're also the only bird consistently forgets it can fly.
I'm just trying to think if we've got national animals, and I guess all is you know, our coat of arms, which, as far as I can remember, is like a lion and a unicorn, possibly.
Yeah,
I think it's possibly a horse.
I'd imagine the English lion probably is.
Yeah, three lions on a shirt.
Now, is the unicorn's Welsh, is it, or is it...
That's a dragon, mate.
The dragon is... Well, okay, yeah, so then the unicorn is Scotland.
You know, I love it how the Welsh, who are also mythical creatures, have a mythical creature...
The Welsh do exist. I've met some.
I know. I've met some Welsh as well. And they've been pretty swell.
They have. But they are what Tolkien based his elves off of. His elves are just the Welsh.
Yeah.
His dwarves are the Scots. His hobbits are the English... Etc. So it's very basic. Mm-hmm. To break it down,
write what you know.
Yeah, but his elves are kind of more Midlandsy farmery English, hence Middle Earth, I guess. The Shire. The places are called the Shires. It's not very deep once you break it down.
No,
but never mind. Right, the pigeons, anyway. They've broken in. They're flying about the place. They're perched on the strip lights. The music continues to be bonkers, now aiming for the more improvisational end of jazz.
Yep.
The end that can fuck off.
Aww.
I like jazz, as long as I'm aware that people are doing stuff rather than some people are playing instruments at the same time.
Can we discuss Spike and Tid's... Tiddler's... ridiculous game of catch the flying paper ball.
Yeah, I think those rules change, because in the establishing shot, Spike's just throwing paper balls over his shoulder and Tiddler's catching them in a bin.
Yeah.
And later on it changes to she holds the bin in place and he tries to get them in.
Yeah.
But the rate is much slower later
exactly.
on.
Exactly.
But yeah, he's making a heck of a mess right at the start. Sorry, Paul, you were going to say something.
I've lost it.
Oh, sorry.
No worries.
That happens. Quite all right.
But yeah, the pace of paper balls he's adding to the floor is quite astonishing.
Yeah.
So it must be slow. And we get someone who I think actually is Jeff this time, using the mimeograph while also acting as a pigeon perch.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, Colin is on the hunt with a big comedy net.
The comedy net.
I don't know where you get one of those nets, but maybe you can.
I know where you get one of those nets.
If you're a comedy character. Yeah.
A hunting fishing store.
Yes, it looked like a fishing net for capturing the not for fishing with per se.
No,
for catching your catch at the end of your line as you're getting ready to bring it in the boat.
I imagine people do fish here. I imagine there's places you can go, but like, I'm just trying to think of like proper hunting and fishing type shops. It's probably because we don't do the guns. I can't think of a place where it's where there is such a big thing, but I know you can buy the stuff somewhere, so he's done that. Right, Linda enters with Bobby and asks him to find a desk, a pen and some paper to write down the whole thing. He says, "I've already told you," which is his dialogue for the entire episode.
Yep.
That is all that he says.
It's really quite funny.
Yes.
He's like at the center of this mystery.
Yeah, and he disappears from it. He's not even featured in like the thrilling climax of his own story. He's not there. That's funny. Anyway, Linda calls a meeting with Kenny, Sarah and Billy and asks Kenny to find out if any members of the news team were at the school judo club the previous night. She tells Kenny the next time she wants to print her address in the paper, he should tell her it was a stupid idea and then duck. Linda, that is a stupid idea.
Yep. Very.
And exists solely for this plot, but never mind.
Agreed.
Right, yeah. Spike has slowed the pace of his balls. Previous shot. Slow your balls, man. Anyway, each time he gets in the bin facing away, Tiddler rates each shot as a hit or a miss if he misses the bin. Linda asks if he's busy. He explains it's just paperwork. Boom!
Ooh. Bang, bang.
Cactus Jack.
As I like to say. Nice. Puns are great. Spike's puns are puns I really enjoy. I really find that his ridiculous little quips are funny and charming. I've completely, at this point, we're in our 10th episode, I've completely forgotten about the horribleness that is his attempt at American accent.
Yeah.
It's just fine. And yeah,
I think I'm just used to it at this point. I'm not sure if it's improving, but I'm definitely getting accustomed to it.
How have you enjoyed my retconning of the situation over the course of the podcast, Paul, where I've kind of explained why he doesn't sound genuinely American anymore? For me, it works.
Yeah, it works pretty well for me, I suppose.
Cool. I've solved the mystery. Hurrah! Anyway, Linda slings Spike a phone book so he can get the headmaster's number. His name is Winters, which we knew, and he lives on Carver Street, which we didn't. It'd be interesting at this point to see if Matt Kerr also lives there, but he's probably too new to the area to be in the book. I'm going to bash this into a running joke if it's the last thing I do.
We have yet to see them in the same shot.
Linda takes his opportunity to try out the word subconsciously with Spike. Is it something you catch from a dirty towel?
God.
Linda asks anyone if he's told him he had a wonderful vocabulary. He said he always knew that, but he could just never put it into words. But he guesses he always knew subconsciously.
Ooh!
Hit. Linda walks away, flinging a paper ball and perfectly hitting the bin. Hit.
Of course she did.
Linda goes over to Billy, and this is where you note Colin and Julie having a hug in the background.
Oh boy, I paused it right there. 4 minutes, 39 seconds.
Yeah.
Oh my.
Because you specifically were surprised by the him having his arm round Julie when doing the business pitch, and I just thought that was him, you know, doing his, you know, I'm your old mate, Colin. But who knows?
Who knows?
Maybe there could be an unexpected love business going on between the design and finance sections of the Junior Gazette.
Maybe.
So are you a coolie shipper?
Coolie.
Yeah, or
I prefer Jolin.
Jolin. Julin.
Julin. Ooh, Julin.
Well, let's see if anything comes of that. Why not Coolie? That's
Coolie's not bad.
Raspberry Coolie. Anyway, so yeah. While that hug's going on in the background, Linda goes off to see Billy, who's got a pigeon on his modem.
Yeah. Way to go, bird. Sitting on like the one guy's thing who can't like brush you off.
Oh yeah, I hadn't thought about that. We get another glimpse at Billy's slight spikiness. They haven't forgotten about it.
Are you busy?
Yes. No.
No.
He's just used to not being bothered. You know, he's a guy who's still used to being able to just do stuff at his own pace in his room. So he's getting the hang of this kind of social business.
Yeah.
Did I interrupt someone there?
No, I'm just saying, I think you're totally right. He's still getting used to... I think he's still getting used to being around people.
Well, she asks Billy to break into the school records to find out everything he can on Bobby Tweed. We learn that Norbridge High took advice from Colin regarding putting student records on computer and hired Billy to set it up, who proceeded to leave himself a back door.
Wow.
I think this is probably the first use of back door as a computing term in a British kids TV show, by the way.
And fantastic.
Amazingly, nobody says the word hack once.
Nope. Well, because no one's driving a cab.
Oh, wow. David Morse humor. Well done. I approve. Was that David Morse? Was it Mark Frost?
I don't remember.
Mark Frost. Wrong guy. Mark Frost, the co-creator of Twin Peaks. No, yes. Chris. Not him. But that would be interesting. Linda angrily shoos a bird out of a drawer. Or Tiddler starts telling Linda that Spike's been having trouble at home.
Oh, he won't I hate to interrupt. Why is Linda not flipping out about these birds?
I think, like any situation, you get used to them.
I guess.
Like, I keep forgetting to take my now fabled car to the mechanics to try and sort it out because it makes a lot of noise all the time and it has almost no oomph, no get up and go. But it does just about get me to the places I'm going to. And I've got used to the fact it's as loud as it is. So I have to keep reminding myself that I definitely need to go and get it sorted out. But I keep failing to do so because a bit of my brain goes, it's all right. But I really do need to. Chris, if you're listening to this and you haven't taken your car to Quick Fit, do it. Thank you.
Do it now.
Yeah. So anyway, that's why I think Linda would have flipped out about the birds when they first happened. And now it's just sort of a thing they're getting used to. You work around stuff. Mm-hmm. Does that assessment work for everyone?
Yes.
Agreed.
I was looking up Tiddler. I was somewhat curious to find that the amount of information on her is remarkably sparse. Partially due to the fact that she didn't move on to anything after Press Gang, I suppose.
Joanna Dukes.
Yes, I found that she was in the Box of Delights, which I remembered from seeing on PBS Wonderworks back in the day. But
yeah, she was in that with Patrick Troughton.
Yes, and I couldn't work out what her actual age is. It almost looks some of what she wears looks like they're trying to age her down a little bit and hide the fact that she has any kind of womanly figure.
Yeah, during filming, she is 16, playing 14.
Okay,
in this year, and obviously she progresses from here. So by the time it finishes, she'll be like 20, of course. But she won't be playing 18 because of Press Gang's crazy dealings with linear time.
Interesting.
The whole series takes place over more like a couple of years than 4 years.
There are
analyses online, but obviously I recommend for the newbies not doing that because you will find out a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
So anyway, Spike's been having trouble at home. Oh, he won't go into detail, but it's upsetting him. Linda's seen no evidence of this, but Tiddler reminds her he's all mouth to hide behind, which is a good phrase. She explains it's his birthday on Friday, a fact that nobody knows about. And I thought we were going to get that kind of dialogue again. There's a new band coming to town he'd like to see. Mm-hmm. How about we get a name for the band? The Dreadnoughts.
Yes.
The Dreadnoughts are playing at the Pavilion, and he'd like to go. He'd really cheer him up if Linda went with him to the show, but she flatly refuses. And here's where I mention her cardigan. This cardigan she's wearing was specifically made for the character by the costume designers of the show. And at least at time of the recording of the DVD commentaries for Series 2, was owned by Julia Sawala's mother. Who'd asked her specifically to, pilfer it from set when they finished recording.
I thought it was a little much, personally. I do have it in my notes, but I wasn't going to bring it up till you did.
I like it. But hey, I like women at the turn of the 90s wearing large, baggy, unform-fitting things. I'm a real strange guy. But there you go. We cut back to Bobby writing about whatever it is he came to see Linda about, because at this point, remember, we still don't know. And we cut to the meeting where we find out too. £30 was stolen from the cash box during last night's judo club. Bobby was seen coming out of the room where the cash box was kept. He was seen in the changing room stashing money in his raincoat. They say anorak. Anorak, is that a word that travels?
Sure.
Cool. He was
We tend to say raincoat.
I mean, anorak here tends to mean something a little bit bigger, like a puff, one of those poofy down coats.
Yeah, parka.
Like a parka.
Yeah, I always knew it to be a kind of very thin raincoat, particularly one you can fold up, or a Macintosh, which we knew as a pack-a-mac.
Huh.
When I was searching to see if anorak was a term that was used elsewhere, most places suggested parkas. You know what we call parkas in this country?
What?
Parkas.
Nice.
That's what they are.
good.
But
good.
There you go.
I just heard pack-a-mac somewhere, possibly the Now Show.
Oh, there you go. That's what a pack-a-mac is.
All right. Yeah, I figured it. I worked it out.
Good stuff. Right, he was seen stashing the money in his anorak. He was searched later. Oh, they say anorak, but later they say bag. Interesting. Anyway,
He was. I noted that it was very strange.
It's probably just Billy's error. Anyway, he was searched later and found to be in possession of exactly £30. During this scene, we see all over denim human, later school uniform human, just strolling about the newsroom in relatively casual, regular clothes because it's actually Sunday. And there you go. It reminded me of rumours you always... I always heard this at school of like I saw unpopular pupil hanging around Eltham on Saturday. He was wearing his school uniform. Ha! You know, these kind of unverifiable stories about...
Yes.
To particularly poor working class kids. Mm-hmm. You know, poorer than I was. And you couldn't verify it. You just went, yeah, I believe that would be the sort of thing that might happen. So I believe you intensely. But anyway, this kid doesn't wear his uniform on a Saturday. So there you go. Despite the obvious solution that Kenny leaps to immediately, which is, you know, well, I wonder who done it. Bobby continues to claim not to be responsible. He claims the money he was found with was given to him by his grandmother, and that everyone who claims to have seen him is involved in a mini conspiracy and lying about it. They can't get confirmation from the grandmother because she's 93 and thinks her cat is Napoleon.
How do we know her cat isn't Napoleon?
Indeed. Linda knows this because she called and the old lady who answered claimed to be the cat. Oh dear.
And very weird.
But everybody wants to be a cat, is my understanding.
That's the only one that knows where it's at.
Yes, precisely. I think a 93-year-old grandmother is just more with it than the kids.
I didn't want to mention this until maybe later, but I think this is the right time. I think this kid is stealing money from his grandmother.
Yeah.
It's £30. Got it from his grandmother, who's kind of crazy, and losing it. I think he's taking advantage of her.
Interestingly, that is a conclusion the episode lets you draw without any kind of, any kind of recourse. That is, I think, actually quite believable. But never mind. Billy didn't find much in Tweed's records because he hasn't been at the school long. He lives in Sherrington. This is confusing because I now suspect there must be a main town called Sherrington, and there's the Sherrington area, which Norbridge is also in.
I see.
But I frankly don't know. I think it's just sort of name words that Moffat used when he needed to, you know. He could have said Macton again, but we know that Macton's at least a train away. But never mind. It's where Jenny Elliott lives. But then again, Macton seems a bit more upmarket.
Well, didn't they say that Sherrington was two train stops away, or two transfers away or something like that? I can't remember.
I think it's two stops on one train. The train fare is £1.50 to get to Sherrington each way. And there you go. So he has to get a train to and from school because he lives in Sherrington. It's not clear why he comes to the school that's so inconvenient, but Billy will carry on looking. But the upshot of this whole thing is that Bobby wants the Gazette to run a private investigation. And I was planning to play Private Investigations by Dire Straits at the end of this, because it ends with that amazing almighty piano section. However, not much to do with Nintendo, so I might not do that after all. But never mind. Anyway, yeah, he wants the Gazette to run a private investigation to determine if he's guilty or not. Sarah and Kenny aren't thrilled, but Linda seems pretty interested and says it's not an unreasonable request, even though it is.
This is weird.
It's, you know, unless they're actually getting a story out of it, and maybe they are, she does say story later, then yes, it's an entirely unreasonable request.
But, see, I see it as an exercise where she's basically getting her team to investigate something actively and build up their investigation chops.
The longer I think about it, I'm wondering if this also comes from Stephen Moffat's father, Bill Moffat's, like, exercises for classes. Because this is exactly a scenario that you could give to a bunch of school kids. You know, with the map and with everything, and with the list of who has what amount of money, and say, solve this mystery.
Yeah.
And that actually is interesting. Because I wonder if it is just adapted from a lesson plan, like the whole series is.
Agreed.
But there you go. Anyway, Linda is up for it because Bobby's too scared to go home and face the apparently violent reprisals of his father. That was back in the day, and you just say, yeah, he's worried his dad will thump him. And everyone would be like, yeah, that makes sense, rather than like, that's terrible. We've come a long way in a very short time as a bunch of societies.
Yeah, it was just the late 80s.
Yeah. It was like 26 years back. It's crazy. But anyway, Linda feels a peculiar sense of responsibility to look into this. It took into it so Bobby will be safe from his paternal ire.
Yeah.
Sarah takes the walks like a duck approach to the whole scenario and declares Bobby guilty instantly.
Yeah, it was, she's not into this at all. She's basically resigned to, I don't know, he sounds pretty guilty to me, let's just, why are we even talking about this?
Yeah.
She's not interested.
Billy, however, like the infuriating sod he is, claims that Bobby simply couldn't have done it, and there's a detail that makes it impossible, but he refuses to say what it is, literally for his own amusement.
Yeah.
And he states it as such.
Yeah.
This is a guy in a wheelchair who has curious insight into a mystery and flat out refuses to tell people about it, which for me proves that Damon Lindelof has seen this episode.
Agreed.
And I'm going to be stretching for more of those as we go on with the series.
And I'm not clear whether Billy actually had enough information to have worked this particular detail out at this point.
He's got the basic gist of it, which is the precise amount of £30 that Bobby has rather than any additional money on top of it. If he had
required for the transportation.
Yeah, if he had £31.50, Billy wouldn't have arrived where he did instantly. And there you go. Right. There's a lot of fun to be had during this scene just watching Colin in the background bombing about after pigeons with his dick dastardly net.
Yes.
It can be extremely distracting. Paul Reynolds, he's really good. I mean, you don't get a real sense of it because he's like the comedy buffoon, but he was like the most professional and was always the most worried that he'd done a bad job as well. And never did.
Nope, never.
Someone, it may have been Paul, I can't remember, a couple of episodes ago said that it was clear that Reynolds is like the best actor of the lot of them.
I don't think that was me, but that's okay.
But you haven't had much of a chance to see it, but he's certainly... He went on to do a lot of work, and he's you know, more of a character actor than a lead guy. He's good. Anyway, never mind. Anyway, rather than tip her hand as to what she believes, Linda puts Sarah and Billy on the story together as prosecution and defence, and leaves the meeting to get Winter's phone number from Spike so she can tell him about the investigation, pausing briefly to ask Spike if he's feeling okay, and telling him to hang in there. Spike is baffled, but thankfully, Tiddler is on hand to explain the situation. See, it turns out Linda's been having some trouble at home. She's really upset about it. Also, nobody knows, but it's her birthday on Friday, and she'd really like to go and see the Dreadnoughts at the Pavilion. So there you go. Was anyone ahead of Tiddler's scheme even before she attempted this tack?
I figured as much.
It would be stupid to say it to both of them, but I think she thought she was really onto a loser with approaching Linda with the idea. But like, if she thinks neither of them are going to say happy birthday when they arrive with the tickets, but I suppose if they're in the place with the tickets, then it's kind of job done.
Yes.
So never mind. Before Linda can make the call to Winters, Julie brings her the artwork for the centre spread she's finished, which if you've been watching the series, you know it's literally the first bit of Julie's work Linda has liked.
Agreed.
Even going so far as to call it beautiful before pigeon crap hits it directly from above.
Yes, there's a critic up there.
Yeah. It stinks. They really are going to have to do something about those birds.
There is a funny thing about, you know, lining a bird cage with paper.
All right. Of course. I watched the DVD. I watched some of the DVD commentaries on series 2. There's 4 commentaries on episodes. It's Stephen Moffat and Julia Sawalha talking about episodes. Turns out he remembers lots. She remembers basically nothing about what they've done. She only remembers. No, I won't say that. Never mind. You'll find out later. And I thought, after these episodes are on, I could rip them off the DVD and put them on our YouTube page so people can go and see them. Till I realised that stuff in the commentary goes into major plot details up to and including the very final episode of the entire run. Funny. So I kind of can't.
Yeah.
Unless I kind of bring out a censored version and then bring out an uncensored version later. And I'm not going to do that.
Nope.
So there you go. And the reason I brought this up is apparently what Julia used to do with her older press gang scripts, once she'd learned it all and they'd filmed it, was she would shred them and use them in her cat's litter tray.
Oh, that's hilarious. Uh-huh.
Rather than keep them and have them as collector's items later.
Yes, yes, yes.
And there's a bit on the commentary where, like, Moffat goes, "I used to think about that while I was typing, go straight from here to Linda's cat's ass." there you go. Talking of collector's items, I was going to mention this later, I'll mention it now. She once auctioned off some of her press gang stuff for charity, and she met a couple of people who bought, like, her boots. They got Julia Sawalha and Linda Day written in them. And apparently they were really peeved. They were really sort of narky with her because they weren't able to get, like, her coat or anything like that. They were like, "Well, we went for the auction and this was all that was left." It's like, so? That's not my problem.
Hey, someone who's really into feet would really kill for that.
Exactly. Moffat's response on the commentary is like, "And these are people with no clue about fetish."
Oh, there you go.
There you go. That's a terrible Moffat, by the way. Sorry, I normally do better, but I'm in a hurry. I'm not in a hurry. You know what I mean. Anyway, enough of that. Later on, we're in school, and Sarah, and this is a particularly relaxed and smiley Sarah. I like this performance. She's normally quite uptight, and you don't get to see this kind of more chilled out version very often. But she's talking to Mr. Prescott about Bobby's case. We're trying to work out if he is a PE or gym teacher, or if he's just the judo instructor, but it doesn't really matter. On this account, he's Mr. Prescott, and he ran judo club.
Yep.
Which people are perfectly happy to talk about. And he's happy to talk to Sarah and the Junior Gazette, because he's impressed by their results so far in terms of getting Bobby to return to school and getting Winters to allow them access to school property and staff in order to carry out the investigation. Prescott, however, thinks the investigation is unnecessary because Bobby stole the money, and he knows he did because he saw him. Piss.
Did he really?
Mm. Earlier in the evening, the cash box had been in the gym. Prescott brings the cash box in case students forget their bus fare home. If they do, he could subsidise them and they aren't left stranded in the evenings, unable to get home, which is good. Later is Sarah is interviewing our super fashionable chum, Keith. Who regular viewers will recognise from the Solvent Sting of How to Make a Killing Part 2, as well as Ian Brown, who is not the former lead singer of the Stone Roses.
Oh.
Also, F-E-A-R. Fantastic record. Ian Brown, F-E-A-R. Anyway, they explained nobody needed fares home, so Prescott put the cash box in a corner, got started on the judo business. At 5 o'clock, he called a break because he needed to make a phone call. Prescott took the cash box with him, left it in the equipment room while he went to the office to use the phone. During this time, the students were just hanging out, chatting, and Keith suggests that at this point it'd be pretty easy for someone to slip away unnoticed. I'm not sure I believe that, but later on we find out that it doesn't really matter whether we believe that or not.
Mm-hmm.
Prescott explains on his way back he saw Bobby leave the equipment room with money in his hand, indicated the window doors that he saw Bobby through. Jerry Hardy, in his nice pink t-shirt, explains that he'd been to the toilet during this time. On his way back to the gym, he also saw Bobby come out of the equipment room with the money and run straight to the changing room. Prescott gave chase, failed to catch Bobby, later finding him back in the gym, claiming never to have left as though nothing had happened, didn't have the money, so Prescott assumed he'd hid it somewhere. Keith and Ian claimed they could see into the changing room from the gym somehow, saw Bobby run in and stuff money into his bag. After which he and at this point, it's just going to have to be bag. The anorak detail seems to have disappeared completely.
Mm-hmm.
After that, bag he just now. Casually strolled into the gym. Prescott checked the cash box. It was down £30 in three tenors, Domingo, Carreras, and Pavarotti. And he called a halt to judo club. And the pupils changed back in their regular clothes, searched both the pupils and the area around the gym. And Bobby's bag had three tenors in it. Boom.
I need to stop for a moment. Everyone stop. Get back into your street clothes.
Yes.
And then I'm going to search your stuff? Like, well, how about everyone stop, nobody move, I'm going to go through the lockers. Well, I think that would make a lot more sense.
Yeah. That school is very unlikely to actually have lockers. It will just have coats and bags hanging on hooks.
Yeah.
In the room, even more so. Lockers aren't really a thing we do.
Okay. But it would just be why give people an opportunity to hide things again by having them get into their street clothes? It's just odd.
Yeah, for me, it only works for the plot because it's essential that when Bobby is seen, he's wearing the same stuff as everyone else, and when he leaves, he doesn't like run out in a judo outfit.
In a judo outfit.
Yeah.
Yes.
Thank you.
And there you go. So that's why that happens, but it doesn't make much sense.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, now we're in Billy's bedroom where someone's helpfully drawn a map. One that shows that if there is any view into the changing room from the gym at all, it's astonishingly minimal, by the way. You'd have to be standing right by the door.
Exactly.
Anyway, Sarah finishes the story detailed above. Prescott confronted Bobby, accusing him directly of stealing the catch, at which point Bobby legged it and we arrive at the start of the episode. And all the crazy beatbox flutes.
Exactly.
Alright, Billy explains that Bobby goes to Norbridge High, even though it's vastly inconvenient, as he's been kicked out of every school in the Sherrington area. We had one of these, who I won't name, when I was at Elton Green. I nearly named him without thinking. He was a fucking tosser, and he got kicked. He got kicked. That's a fine name, anyway. He was kicked out of our school in, like, I think the second year, back when it was called the second year and not year nine or whatever it is now. And went on a tour literally of every available school within his catchment borough, and they all booted him out again until he arrived back at ours.
What?
Because there was no other school for him to go to.
Really?
Yes. And
that's
continued to be a little wanker.
So he's a bit of a mythical creature, this guy.
No, he also wasn't mythical. I met him too.
Oh.
His first name was Michael, I'll give you that one, but I'm not doing the rest of it.
Michael Jerkface.
Yes, Michael Toss.
Michael Hunt.
No, that's very good.
Very good.
Michael Jerkson. Comforter Jackson. Oh no, that's a different podcast.
Yep.
Oh dear, I'd forgotten about Comforter Jackson. Let's move on. Anyway. Bobby Tweed has been kicked out of every school in the Sheraton area for the usual stuff, fighting, stealing, running protection rackets, and arson. Sarah says...
Burning down the school.
Yeah, like Buffy.
Full of vampires.
Yeah, in the events that didn't actually happen in the film but were retconned later.
Yep.
Sarah says he's not exactly Young Person of the Year, which is a stupid statement because everyone knows Young Person of the Year is James Armstrong.
James Armstrong.
But anyway, Billy and Sarah, meeting in Billy's room, of course, at 26 Laurel Avenue, they agree this information puts a lid on the case once and for all, but they disagree on why. Sarah's convinced because this proves he's exactly the kind of guy who'd steal the money, whereas Billy, dropping the hint of because it's because of where he lives, says he couldn't have done it. Like, are you well ahead of the plot at this point? Because it is a whodunit for kids, that's...
No.
No, cool. No, not at all.
That's good. He's still not telling Sarah about it, but he encourages her to think about it. And here's where I realise that Billy does... I think Billy is loving this because he's clearly always fancied himself as a kind of amateur detective.
Yeah.
His first TV review sent to the Gazette was of a Ruth Rendell mystery. And you may recall in How to Make a Killing Part 2, he unsubtly leads Kenny towards the idea that the figure is pointing to the shops where the glue is sold. Because Billy's already worked that shit out. You know, he's not. He's just sort of guiding the situation. And I think this is just a thing Billy does for a laugh now, to kind of have a sense of power over people.
Yeah.
He could dole it out. I mean, if in this case it came down to it and someone just flat out asked him to, so they could put it to bed, he would just tell them. But at this point, he's being a dick. Because he is a bit of a dick. Which is, I still like.
Yeah, I like that a lot. It's definitely part of his character, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Chris, I need to interrupt the podcast for a moment.
Okay.
I've been recording off the wrong mic.
Okay.
So, do I keep recording with the really crappy mic? Which is attached to a device with a fan blaring, or do I switch up?
It's not sounding problematic to me. I think if it's if we've got it this far, I think we'll just stick with it, if that's
okay,
all right.
Okay, we'll do.
And whether I'll catch that bit to edit out the podcast, I don't know. I would leave
Sorry
that in
that.
So that people realise that, you know, that if there is a problem in sound quality, you're aware of it.
Okay.
Oh, you've gone.
Have I? Oh, no, here's the thing. Yeah, okay. So the microphone I'm using for Skype is the one in front of my face. The one I'm actually recording is the one about a foot away.
Okay.
That's the problem. So you wouldn't actually hear the terribleness.
Yeah. But, like, we've got this much of the show already recorded like that.
Agreed.
I would go with
we'll
consistency. Because, like the birds, people can adapt.
This is true. I will make a note of this for next time, make sure I don't forget to do this thing.
No worries. Anyway, Sarah, at this point, points out there are four separate witnesses to this crime, which should blow Billy's detail completely out of the water. And that does give him something to think about. And then Billy sends Sarah away in his usual tactful manner.
Yeah.
God. It's like, do you have to go? No. Can you tell my dad to send a coffee on your way out? Yeah, thanks, mate. So, yeah, he's still not quite used to being with people.
No.
I don't know what the original running order was meant to be, but I know that this series is not in the order it was written. I said that before, like, Billy was in Deadline and had to be sort of edited out of the episode because they showed it before his introduction.
Okay.
So whether, like, this is meant to be before Billy's really got the hang of... So, I mean, as far as we know, this could be the one that directly follows Interface. Probably
yeah,
isn't,
we don't know.
Because he's had time to set up the school computer system. But then again, they've also had time to get a pigeon infestation at the Junior Gazette. There's never any sense of how much time has passed. Anyway, back at the newsroom, Spike and Linda enter mid-argument again, still bickering about whether she should go out with him. She must want to go out with him because she bought tickets to see the Dreadnoughts. In the background, Garfield has moved from Linda's desk to the radiator, where he could better act as an audience. And what do you see above Garfield?
Trivial Pursuits.
Yes. Trivial Pursuit /S. And, it's made his way into the office. Last time we saw one of those was during Linda's excursion into Spike's bedroom and never in the newsroom itself. That's interesting. I wonder if it got there subconsciously. But,
subconsciously.
That's a great touch anyway. A really, really, really good touch.
Yeah.
And it pays off for people who watch the series and for, you know, otherwise it's just a bit of a board game that people didn't put away properly. But there you go. Spike finds the tickets, Linda's tickets, and it's revealed that Tiddler has explained that he is the intended recipient of her spare. Spike plans the evening in advance, planning to arrive early so that he can talk to her parents, see the baby photos. He asks her advice regarding clothes. He thinks he should wear some. Or the parents might think he's being a bit forward. Linda notes that it's a dream come true for Spike and asks him to deny that he's dreamt about this exact moment. She knows he has, and she can prove it. She does this by clicking her fingers, and then Linda wakes up in bed at home. Damn.
Yes, this was a wonderful spin on the whole dream thing and waking up thing, and she wakes herself up from her dream. which is great. Really great.
Subversion times. Linda wakes up in bed at home. She looks over to the bedside cabinet and we see that at least the tickets are real.
This is true.
We're outside the Junior Gazette building with Billy Sarah, Kenny, Fraz, and Danny. And this is, frankly, probably the best look we're ever going to get at this building. And it's... I actually only realised that it was the Gazette building on this viewing. In the past, I've never paid much attention to it, and I assumed it was, like, in school grounds.
Yeah, yeah.
Somewhere. But no, it's just that we don't see that side. And it's got a little tower in the corner and things like mm-hmm. that. It's got some exit doors, the like, facing Gazette House that I was not expecting either. Lots of rooms up the side.
And can I just say how reckless and terrible it is for these kids to have basically pilfered every single fire extinguisher they could get their hands on? It is absolutely irresponsible and careless. It's terrible.
What's even worse is that's a through road. People need to drive through that to get to Mill House. But never mind. Billy has constructed a scale model of the area around the gym. Very 12 Angry Men, this bit. Mm-hmm. It's a bit in 12 Angry Men where someone tries to say how fast an old fella could get down a corridor with a limp, and they kind of measure it out with the tables. 12 Angry Men is great, by the way.
Yeah.
Thought I'd throw that in there. If you like courtroom dramas, it's the daddy of them all. Billy has constructed this model. All of the rooms featured in the various testimonies are represented. Sarah's surprisingly sarky in this scene. It's very unusual.
She's really not into this at all.
No. Excuse me, loud coughing noise. That'd be the loud cough that I just did. So, Billy wonders how much of a head start Bobby must have got on Prescott in order for him to have been seen with the money, but have time to stash it and stroll into the gym before Prescott could catch up. And he gets Kenny and Fraz to demonstrate the distance required, which is thusly the distance at which Prescott needs to have visually identified Bobby in a partly lit corridor after school hours. This is very clever stuff. I like this.
Mm-hmm.
The fire doors between Prescott and Bobby had glass panels, but because they're fire doors, they were wired glass, which would cause a hit in visual fidelity. And even though we are familiar with Bobby wearing that horrendous jacket, at the time he and all the other pupils at judo club would have been wearing identical judo kits. Billy reckons that means Prescott simply couldn't have been sure it was Bobby he saw. And that Prescott knows this, which is why he searched everyone and not just Bobby. I think maybe it's just that Prescott is quite a fair guy and wanted to make sure he wasn't picking on anyone. But there you go.
Which is excellent, by the way.
That is excellent.
That is a little detail that I noticed right away and thought, wow, this is really, really great.
Mm. As much as, like, searching high school students is great.
Well, yeah.
But, like, you say, we were different back then. And PE teachers are never known for their adherence to decent social norms. You may have remembered my detail of the Tancred special earlier the violent outburst that my former PE teacher Pete Tancred would offer up if you were being a little shit. And I never was, so I never received the Tancred special. So there you go. Billy calls over Danny with some photographs of the corridor he prepared earlier, asking Sarah if she can recognise Bobby in the picture. She thinks she can, which is interesting, because it's Kenny.
Oh, yes.
Sick burn. And yeah, he hands the zoomed-in picture, which makes it very clear it's Kenny.
Mm-hmm.
Poor Sarah looks very embarrassed like this, and her Xander Harris-like certainty falls away. I don't like Xander Harris, so I think I've made that clear before.
Yeah.
Are you enjoying this so far, Paul? The episode, that is?
Oh, absolutely, yes.
Cool. Back at the newsroom, we learn that, in the real world at least, both Spike and Linda have bought a pair of tickets for the Dreadnoughts, but are too shy to actually ask the other one out on an actual date. They have trouble with anything that isn't flirty repartee, basically. Yeah. Before Linda can bite the bullet and ask, they're accosted by Colin with an umbrella covered in bird shit. He says they're picking on him. Well, I've never heard it called that before. Which is quite a rude joke.
It is.
Spike tells him, "Forgive and ye shall be forgiven," and Linda is instantly stunned at Spike quoting the Bible, even though she's never given any indication she has much interest in the Bible or what it says. He could have heard that anywhere, and that the Bible isn't exactly a brief history of time.
Well,
sorry, Bible fans.
It's not brief, neither is it history, nor do I have time for it.
Wow. Very impressed. Very impressive. Speaking of being impressed, Linda remains impressed anyway, and she tells him the quotation is from Matthew, which it isn't. It's Luke 6:37. Luke 6:38, of course.
Austin 3:16 says, sorry.
I've got Luke 6:38, of course, says, I just whooped your ass. And that's the bottom line, because St. Luke said so. However, Linda is happy to interpret this one comment as meaning Spike is a big old softy beneath his hard exterior. A hard exterior, I point out, that we've barely seen since the first couple of episodes.
Agreed. Can we just discuss how this is... Why is she constantly trying to justify liking him? It's really quite something.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, we've known him for 10 episodes, and the school have known him for years as a kind of tearaway troublemaker. We haven't had enough of that, despite occasional sort of jokes about his past. But yeah, he needs to have had more of a kind of, you know, there need to be more people who are scared of him, for instance, in case they think he's going to punch him. For instance, they need stuff like that. Because this is clearly the kind of thing he was meant to have done earlier, but all of his escapades from the past actually mostly sound like fun japes.
Yeah.
Rather than anything. Anyway, an attempt by Linda to have a nice conversation about how she sees Spike is misinterpreted by him so drastically that he ends up confessing to having hung Linda's underwear up on the school flagpole during sports day, which he then tries to get out of having admitted to with the astonishingly thin excuse, I fell.
Can we just highlight how wonderful it is that we finally get closure on what happened during school sports day?
Oh, I wonder if... I never even thought that this was the same event. But yes, it was a talk about the thing he did during school sports day that was disgusting.
Yes.
So yeah, I guess that was...
This was the school sports day thing.
Wow. Linda had never been bothered by it before because she had assumed it was the knickers of one Betty Hunter.
Betty Hunter.
That had ended up flapping in the breeze. Escape hatch which Spike is happy to jump through. Though accidentally,
by saying he recognized them.
Yes. Actually leads to the other embarrassing claim in front of the girl he fancies that he's familiar with this girl's panties because he recognized them. Spike has changed, though. That was the old him. The new one wouldn't find that funny at all. A position severely compromised. Yeah, sorry, Paul.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, does a flagpole prank actually exist in real life? I've seen it as a meme various places in the past.
Well, I suppose so, but can I tell you one thing I've never seen at any UK school?
What?
A flagpole.
Really?
Not in a kind of comprehensive school or anything like that, no.
Interesting. My children's elementary school has two flagpoles.
Yeah, it's a big thing in some places, but here, not so much. Like, maybe in some of the confusing public/private schools, as previously discussed, yes. Yeah. Maybe somewhere like Dulwich College, but Eltham Green, no. Kentwood, no. Forest Hill Boys, no. Norbridge High, almost certainly not. But there you go. Although Spike wouldn't find this funny at all, that position is severely compromised by him instantly giggling when Linda says, underwear on a flagpole. Anyway, there's a very confusing discussion now about why the upcoming Friday is so important to the other one, due to Tiddler's machinations. Linda leaves in a hurry past the kid who's put his school uniform back on.
Yes. And,
Spike
school
and,
uniform guy!
Yay! Or Sug. Can't call him that. Because if Suggs from Madness ever shows up in this series, it's going to be very confusing.
Oh dear.
So anyway... Yeah, Spike and Linda have a quick conversation about who gets to leave and slam the door, a competition that Linda wins after Spike finally flat out asks if she wants to go out on Friday. And not hearing Colin's plea that she not slam the door, slams the door, causing an enormous blast of pigeon activity and a wave of downwardly aimed crap.
When Spike was trying to get her not to leave, initially he did some desktop leaping, some hurdling over desktops.
Yeah, he loves it. That dude can clear the ground like nobody's business. You may recall at the end of Photo Finish, he leaps about 14 feet in the air.
Yeah.
And yeah, he's very happy to get from ground to desk height. Frankly, something I was able to do at that age as well, and now, no. Very much not within my field of ability.
I have never been able to jump.
Wow.
I can try, but I've never been able to clear anything. Mm. Just a disaster.
I'm sorry to hear that.
It's okay.
No. Spike, by the way, however, having been on the top of desks, now avoids pigeon activity by filling himself under a desk. Linda pokes her head back in to survey the carnage. Spike asks, "That was a no, right?" And then takes a pigeon to the face about as coolly as one can.
That was awesome.
It's very impressive. Anyway, that's enough of the love for the moment. We're back to Sarah talking about the money aspect of the episode. And she says, "Well, that is interesting because it's Kenny," and hands him the zoomed-in photo that proves he's an unreliable witness. He agrees he could have been mistaken. Sarah suggests the other three witnesses, being pupils, would not be as credible as witnesses without Prescott being able to claim 100% he's old Bobby Tweed. Prescott, however, thinks this doesn't mean anything. He checked everyone, and only Bobby had £30 in £10 notes, the exact figure that went missing. Bobby could have claimed it was planted on him, but immediately claimed it was his own money. So Sarah asks if it could have been his own money, and if it was, then where did the stolen money go? Sarah asks a very intelligent question at this point, which is whether Prescott carried on searching after he'd found the three tenors.
I really enjoyed Prescott's expression of, "You know what? You're darn right I did."
Yes, he looks very smug.
Very smug and very happy
with himself. Yeah, but great question. Very investigative reportery. I'm very impressed with it. But yeah, it turns out he did, and he made a note of how much money everyone had. And later, Sarah's back in Billy's room and shows him the list, which includes, by the way, Tom Green and John Avery. Sadly, not James Avery. It's a shame it wasn't James Avery. The Shredder, a.k.a. Uncle Will from Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
Yeah. I noticed Jerry spells his name with a G.
Yep, he does indeed. Jerry Hardy, Keith, with an IE.
Keith is a Keith Evans.
He is.
And
there's like a Ronald someone.
There's a Jim Davis, which is the creator of Garfield.
That must be deliberate.
That has to be deliberate. There's lots of Garfield in Billy's room.
Yes, he's got these log-off poster, hasn't he?
And a little birthday card thing with a dog and Mr. Garfield.
Yeah, Billy Scott sounds like a jazz musician, but I'm just probably thinking of either Ronnie Scott or Jimmy Scott. And when I say Jimmy Scott, I'm thinking of Jimmy Smith, the keyboard player. So I'm double wrong. It's probably just... Also, there's a Roger Kane... Bless
Sorry,
you.
Loud sneezing noise.
There's a Roger Kane and a George Moore. I'm thinking Roger Moore, but Moore is spelt like the African tribe. That's not an African tribe, sorry, but you know what I mean. The Moors, the M-O-R-S, without an E.
Not to be confused with the Moops, Jerry.
Yes. It's weird having him as Robert Tweed. Underlined, but there you go. Yeah, I'd forgotten about Jim Davis. But yeah, probably a couple of kids, only got 20p to get back, but that would have been perfectly enough for a child's bus fare at the time. And I have immense money nostalgia, because currently bus fares, much more than that, and you can't pay by cash anymore. It's all done on prepaid card.
So we can still pay by cash.
Good. But when you come to London, you won't be able to. You'll need an Oyster card.
No, we learned that. We had to get one of those temporary Oyster cards and... Mm. All that jazz.
Yeah. Sorry, Paul, say again?
No, I don't think so.
Oh, okay. I keep worrying that I'm interrupting people because I've got a real fucking problem with it. But anyway.
Oh, no, it's all good.
Right. As I say, some of the kids have as little as 12p, others 20p, others, such as our elegant buddy Keith, have as much as £12, but lo and behold, Bob is the only one with 30 quid. Sarah is adamant that this shuts the investigation down for good. But Billy is not only not dissuaded, he sees something in this list of names and figures, the names of figures, that hugely reinforces the secret detail he's been working under this whole time.
And this tiny detail has now grown larger. Mm.
Now, as viewers, have you arrived at it yet?
I think so. Yes. I think upon my first watch at this point, I was on track with what was about to happen.
Cool. Because I don't have any memory of when I saw this the first time. I don't know if I saw it in 89 or since. So I can't remember if I worked it out or not. basically.
However, I did not factor in the bus fare as what would have discounted Bobby as the suspect.
Gotcha.
I was only looking at the other thing.
Now, what I was wondering about is, are these kids typically getting to school on the bus as well, or the train or whatever? Because having an even 30 pounds means that, you know, he didn't break any of them for the trip.
Unless he had 31.50 yes. when he started.
Indeed.
Or he had his £1.50 and he knew he was going to see his gran, who was either going to give him money or he was going to steal it. There's a lot that is not quite worked out in it.
But of course, if you are the train isn't going to break your tenner for you. You've got to have the £1.50.
That's true. I think
exact.
I think a train ticket office could have handled a tenner at the time for a
£1.50
fare. But yes, I do see what you mean. Anyway, back at the newsroom, Sarah has called Prescott and Keith and Ian and Jerry, all the witnesses, together so to go over some final details. She enjoys
this
the word
all Columbo, man.
Yeah, she enjoys the word details. This it is a double Columboing. This moment is somewhat spoiled by a bird dropping from the ceiling. Colin picks it up, and his voice from the future and at a recording studio tells us yep. he's experimenting with drugged bird seed. That's the bird seed aspect of the title.
Yes. Not drugged raisins. He's not doing a Danny Champion of the World per se.
Oh, nice. Or the drugged onions of With Nile and I fame. Why have you drugged their onions? But sorry, that's a long form joke with Danny the roadie who drugged some rats with some onions. He talks like this, man. You might know him as the guy from Wayne's World 2 who talked like this as well. He was a parody of that same character, man. Anyway, the reason I was watching the DVD commentaries is that there was an anecdote about this very business, the drugged pigeons. There's a scene that was scripted and never seen, which involved Linda talking to Colin about the drugged pigeons while she was holding an unconscious pigeon. They had a pigeon wrangler, which is basically a guy who had a van full of pigeons. And you know, during the day, some of them sort of nod off and things like that. And they asked the wrangler if he happened to have, like, an unconscious pigeon or a sleeping pigeon. He said no, he didn't, but he did have a dead one. I thought, well, that's weird. But if you've got this many pigeons, like, maybe one has not survived the journey, for instance. And they go, okay, that would probably do it. So he went out the back to get the dead pigeon. And it became very clear pretty quickly that the pigeon wasn't actually dead at the time he'd made the offer.
Oh, no!
But he went out and, as Moffat puts it, briefly consorted with the pigeon and made it become a dead pigeon.
He murdered a pigeon?
He murdered a pigeon with his bare hands, presumably. And brought it in and handed the newly dead pigeon to Julia Sawalha.
Oh my god.
Then had to do a comedy scene with Paul Reynolds alongside this lolling pigeon. Apparently, like, it put her off the scene, and apparently it looked so dreadful on screen. It just didn't look funny or anything like that. It was clearly a dead pigeon. They just cut it completely, and Julia was really upset, and Moffat claims that everyone blamed him for coming up with the idea in the first place.
I suppose there wasn't an RSPCA notice at the end saying no animals were harmed.
There was not. My favourite one I've seen is in an Australian horror film called Patrick, about a guy who's in a coma but has telekinetic abilities. And I think there's a doctor who demonstrates something about spinal columns by literally sticking a surgical needle into the spinal column of a frog, a living frog, and killing it that way. And the credit at the end said something like, frogs killed under supervision of, like, and the name of an organisation.
Oh.
I've never seen anything like it. It's amazing. But yes,
it's on the books.
A pigeon was harmed during the making of this episode. Sorry about that. It would have upset Julia, because I've been waiting for the right moment to bring this up. Julia's a bit of a sensitive soul. Not Linda, but Julia Sawalha herself. And I'm sorry, guys, but I have to tell you that in reality, Julia Sawalha believes in fairies.
Oh,
nice.
She really believes in actual fairies and other sort of new agey, non-scientific things.
Oh.
Which is why...
Has she purchased any captured?
I don't know. Wow, that's good. That doesn't quite put me off her, but yeah, it's why she had to... it's why she no longer goes out with the comedian Richard Herring. Because they went out together. That's a strange story, because he was like obsessed with her on the telly, and then they were in a play together, and they eventually went out with each other. It was really weird. But like, when he's got a whole stand-up show about being sort of unlucky in love, and he was like, he explained the breakup was like, you know, personally, I like science. I don't think fairies are real. And there you go. Whether Julia Sawalha's fairy belief will come back into the plot later, I don't know. But I thought this was the time to mention it. Anyway, yeah. We're in the denouement. How was that?
It's great.
Denouement?
Denouement, yes.
Cool. Billy lays it all down. Ever since the beginning, he's been troubled by the fact that Bobby was found with the exact £30 he was meant to have stolen, meaning that at no point did he have a required train fare to get him home. Tweed said nothing when the class was asked prior to the money being stolen if they had their fare. Billy then surmises the most logical answer is that the 30 quid actually was Bobby's, the gift from his grandmother, as previously stated, and would have partially acted as his train fare home.
Yeah.
Next, Billy dissects the notion that Bobby was seen coming out of the equipment room with the cash, and having realised this, pelted back to the... having realised he'd been seen... pelted back to the changing room, gambling on not having been recognised in order to hide the money. But Billy finds it hard to believe that Bobby would use his own bag as a hiding place, rather than stash it in other pupils' bags. Like, you know, nothing ventured, nothing gained. You know, I don't get the money, but at least I don't get caught. You know?
Exactly.
But luckily, he has a better idea of how you could get away with stealing 30 quid in 3 tenners if you had two mates. Then he launches into his final salvo. Because £30, this £30 is not £30, it's three £10 notes. And if you've got two mates in the judo club, you could chuck up a tenner each. None of you are found to have the stolen £30.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of looking for one guy with exactly £30, you'd be looking for three guys with at least £10 each. And it just so happens there are exactly three of those guys. And would you know it, that they are the three eyewitnesses who also named Bobby as the thief. And they're here tonight. Jerry Hardy, Ian Brown, and most devastatingly of all, Harold Powell.
Keith.
Keith, man, we thought you were cool. We thought we knew you. More fool us, Keith. Sad fucking face.
No.
Boo. Billy is adamant it proves Bobby didn't take the money, which it doesn't really.
No, it doesn't.
And Jerry is of the opinion it doesn't prove anything, which is closer to the mark. However, Prescott still suggests that he and the headmaster will have a chat with them tomorrow. The trio get ready to leave, but during this denouement, and this is where I've finally written denouement, nobody has noticed Sarah slip away. She's gone over to the phone and is about to pull a con of her own, tricking very thicko Ian into thinking she's talking to his mother.
Thicko?
Yeah, thicko. He's very stupid. The only person taken in by this ruse.
Yeah.
Telling the fictional mother that he's already admitted to stealing the money. Oh, it's very sad. It provokes an uncontrolled outburst from Ian, where he implicates himself and Keith, but mostly Jerry. This doesn't mean you're forgiven, Keith. Anyway, outburst over, Sarah reveals she'd in fact been on the line to the speaking clock.
And that speaking clock is ultra convenient.
Yeah, it is. And a waste of money. All she needed to do was like pick up the phone or like press one number so the dial tone wasn't heard.
But eventually, doesn't it go into a repetitive tone? I know here it did.
It does the triple tone. At the third stroke, the time sponsored by Accurist will be, and it gives the time, and then the three strokes, and the third boop is the exact time previously stated. That's how you could synchronize it to the second.
Were you talking about the off-the-hook tone?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's what I meant.
Yes.
Oh, I see the dial tone. Yes, also true.
Well, I got very confused. Because after you leave a phone off the hook for long enough, it... does a very loud, repetitive tone so that you hear, oh, wait, I've not hung up the phone.
That is true. I can't remember if it did that at the time in the UK, because I remember a lot of people leaving their phone off the hook for long amounts of time. But But the speaking clock is something we all knew and were familiar with the sound of, so it's an instant kind of, oh, very good.
Yes.
But anyway, so yeah, Sarah reveals she'd been on the line for the speaking clock, which, as self-incriminating finales go, isn't really up there with Columbo getting Dick Van Dyke to pick that right camera off the shelf. Uh-huh. But it's not bad for kids' TV. I didn't pick on the Dick Van Dyke one because I saw the end of that episode yesterday and it's a work of brilliance.
Yeah.
They trick him into picking up that camera. Amazing. Anyway, Linda returns to see the drug pigeons being evicted from the newsroom, and Colin assures her the little Nazis can't get back in again. And we get a splendid combo of comedy timing in performance and editing, and Colin promises to see them on their way later with a tennis racket. Cut to Spike claiming he missed her at the pavilion when he definitely went there to see the dreadnoughts. Mm-hmm. Linda's surprised by this, as she didn't see him there when she definitely went to see the dreadnoughts. Both of them and their dates enjoyed the show very much, whether secluded up the back or in the more expensive seats. Linda walks off to her desk and they both sit for a while, and they both tear up their unused tickets for the dreadnoughts at the pavilion and try to throw them in the same bin, instead freezing when they clock the other one. Luckily, Tiddler is on hand, grabbing the shredded paper, throwing it into the bin, declaring miss. And there's your episode, apart from the end credits. In the end credits, Linda has written subconsciously 14 times on the back of a folder to remind herself how to spell it. And another folder apparently proves she's also reminded herself how to spell Spike.
How to spell Spike, yes. Yay!
Cool.
And Tiddler's cousin's band, the Dreadnoughts, is the only one to profit.
Yes! The pavilion made 4 ticket sales.
Yes!
They didn't make any drink sales.
Nope.
And that's where the real money is.
It is.
That's
concessions.
Yeah. As Krusty the Clown might say, that's the sweetest plum!
That was great.
Yeah. Bobby Tweed has one line and doesn't feature in the climax of his own story.
Nope.
I have a further thought about this, but it's informed by something in Matt's feedback, because I once again heard it. I usually don't listen beforehand, but I did on this occasion again. What do you reckon to this? Anyway.
I thought it was great. I enjoyed the mystery aspect.
Mm.
I really enjoyed Billy and Sarah working together.
Yeah, we haven't really seen
them
together before.
I thought Linda's dream sequences were fantastic.
Mm.
I'm so happy we got closure on the school sports day. And I thought that Tiddler was being a scamp.
Yes. Nice. Were you happy that this is the episode you're on, Paul, or would you have preferred something like with more dramatic weight?
No, I think I'm a better at the softer ones.
Nice.
Yes.
I do like this. I have the same. I'm going to admit to liking uncool bands again. Extreme, slightly Christian-y rock band.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't really get into the lyrics all that much, apart from when it does. But there's a track on Extreme 2 Porno Graffiti called Money in God We Trust. And it was like one of my least favourite songs on the album. So when I got it on CD after having the cassette for a while, I used to skip it.
Mm-hmm.
Skip it each time. And then I'd skip it for years. And then one day I heard it and it was like everything I used to like about Extreme when all the stuff was new to me. Like, yes, this is great. Why did I used to skip this? And of course, I only enjoyed it because I used to skip it all the time.
Yeah.
And this episode of Press Gang is not one that I tend to remember, or if I'm going to go, oh, I'm going to watch an episode, just an episode, I don't pull out this one. This one only happens when I'm doing the whole series.
Hmm.
And so I always think that it's not that great. But I do like it. I think this is going to merge into ratings at the end of this.
Yeah.
Which is fine. And so, I'm going to go into my rating then. Because I feel I downvoted last week's Both Sides of the Paper. I called that one a 3, and I think that should have been a 4. And I like this a lot, but I think this one is at least as good as that, but not as good. And I called that a 3 this time. So I'm calling this one a 3 as well.
Got it.
And that's the best I could do for you. how are you? I think the how about Paul next for the rating? Mm-hmm. I only went first with ratings because it was an accident.
Yes, yes. No, I thought it was good. I liked a lot of the interplay with the Spike and Linda and the dream sequence and everything.
Mm.
But you know, ultimately, it didn't seem like it was it was smaller stakes, like you said, filet mignons, maybe not a porterhouse.
oh dear.
So I will also give it a 3 of 5.
Awesome. All right, so
I'm giving this a 4.
Whoa.
Oh, I thoroughly enjoyed most of this. I thought it was great. Not enough backstory on the pigeons and Colin.
No, they just got in through a hole.
Yeah, sure. And it wasn't some kind of Colin scheme. Not enough scheming Colin to push it up to a 5.
I just figured they looked at his shirt and figured it was already a target for pigeon crap. But it was the design.
Yes. No, I thought it was really wonderful. And again, that sports day closure for me made it definitely a 4.
That's excellent. All right, what have we got next? Oh, we've got... before the feedback, we've got
some best dress, worst
dress. We have. Do you hear that sound in the background? Of course you don't.
I do.
No, you don't, because I haven't done it yet. What you're hearing...
Oh, you're talking about a different sound than I'm hearing, then.
Yeah, you're hearing the reverse tail of the inverted reverb I'm going to put on the Ramjack podcast sting.
Oh.
That is, and I'm going to do that in post, which is why you're not hearing it now. However, the people at home are going to hear it lead straight into the sting right now as we present... Best Dressed, Worst Dressed, as sponsored by RamjackPodcast.com. That'd be 2 weeks in a row that I fucked with that using audio effects. I don't think I'm going to carry on doing that. I just get bored.
Yeah.
Right. Paul, as the guest, do you have a Best Dressed and Worst Dressed?
Well, you know, I did notice one thing about the wardrobe is that they definitely didn't have enough costumes for the number of days they were doing, because people no. were re-wearing a bit here and there.
Well, we don't have much money.
Oh, yes, that's all right. I did enjoy the one conspirator with the pink shirt. It definitely looked like a British Zach Morris.
Yeah, that's Jerry Hardy.
And a schemer. I was not big on the cardigan. I actually did not like the cardigan. That was going to be on my worst side.
That's all right. You know, people can have different opinions about things. I just don't agree with you.
I think it was the worst, but Colin's red power tie at the end was a little bit... and then I've got to say, it wasn't on screen long enough for it to be worst, but Tiddler really had quite a splash of color at the end there.
Was that the mega super colored jacket that we've seen before with all the squiggles?
It might have been. I don't know. She was just right at the end when she was when she grabbed the tickets and said Miss, there was a particularly colorful... could take a peek.
Oh, yes, it's the squiggle jacket and the red and black skirt again. But without the ping earrings, which is what really ties it together.
Oh, I think so.
The episode she first had that on, I counted the amount of colours in that thing, and I can't remember where I arrived at. I think I was at least 7, including the various different greens.
Yeah. What she's wearing at the end of it reminds me of traditional... folkloric Portuguese dancer garb from the little community center little things we'd have during Canadian Portuguese put on events that would coincide with the holidays in Portugal. That is basically that's the kind of flashback with that.
Bom dia and obrigado.
Yes, damn right. Obrigado, obrigado.
Oh, that's and just her, confusing.
Yeah, and her skirt definitely would have fit in at my my high school. Our colors were red and black, so
nice. Right, Elirio, what say you?
Linda in Dream Number One looked fantastic.
Oh, the blue top.
Yeah, I really enjoyed Colin at the end with the red tie.
Nice, power Colin.
Worst dressed. This isn't fair, but Mr. Prescott in his gym clothes.
Oh, what about Ian? What about Ian's crap like multicolored jacket?
Yeah, but for me, every girl in PE class was worst dressed.
You saw them in the background.
Yes, they're short shorts. Girls, stop. Stop that. Just get a different uniform.
Is this the same issue as Jenny Elliott's culottes in How to Make a Killing Part 1?
Similar, yes.
Dear, oh dear. All right, I'm back on the Linda train as well, I'm afraid. Sorry, guys, one-track pony and all that. However, mine is in the second dream sequence outfit. Black and white skirt, long sleeve red shirt over white t-shirt. Solid. Spot on.
Solid.
Worst dressed, I got almost certainly Bobby Tweed.
Yeah.
Although, and that's more to do with the time, and I've been very like, oh, I don't want to mark things down because of changing fashions, but like, dear Lord. However, I also have to mention that Billy is first seen in an overwhelmingly blue sweater that deserves some mention.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of swamps the poor guy.
Yeah.
And there you go. It's time for some audio feedback. And I think we've got enough emails for everyone to have a read. I tell you what, shall I send the... I'm going to send one of these to you, Paul, if that's all right for you to read. Fine. Hold on a second. Just doing this as we went. I've already found it. Never mind. Won't put your email address on the podcast. Right, that's been sent. We have a voicemail and we have two emails. And the benefit of there being two emails is I get to shut up for a bit. And that's a benefit for everyone.
But if you say so.
Very good. However, right, Matt A, or rather Matt, as he is on this podcast, has sent in a voicemail. Please feel free to start that up and pause it and synchronize to the beginning of the file, please.
All right.
I am ready.
Are you all ready?
Yes.
Paul, would you like to count as 1, 2, 3, go, and press play on go?
All right, I could do that.
Cool.
1, 2, 3, go.
All right, knuckle draggers. This feedback is going to be brief because I don't have too much to say about this one. Mm. The mystery of who stole the 30 pounds was not that compelling to me. Perhaps if we had had higher stakes, like if we had known this chap, Bobby, I don't know his name, if we had known him,
something seems to be a pretty high stake.
And there was some threat of him being expelled from school or put in some kind of detention facility or something, this would have been more tense. But I didn't know that kid and these other kids and that guy, and it wasn't very good. I did enjoy the moment when they were assembled in the press gang accusing parlor.
Hooray.
That was fun. This episode was mostly about Linda and Spike and the will they, won't they, and Tits playing matchmaker.
Oh, no.
Whenever Linda woke up from her dream, I chuckled. That was good stuff. The birds were weird and random, but very, very funny how for the majority of the episode they were just there. Everyone kept saying, we should really do something about these birds. Yeah, you should. They're shitting everywhere. It's fucking disgusting. So I'm not too keen on this episode, but perhaps your podcast, which is always humorous and informative, will change my mind. As of right now, I'm going pretty low. I'm going to give this 1 out of 5 junior reporters felled by histoplasmosis.
Nice.
Yeah, bye.
I suppose it's like toxoplasmosis, but with bird crap, right?
Histoplasmosis is also something that can be acquired, found in bad guano.
Oh, I see. Well, that would make a lot of sense then.
Yeah.
Right, here's where I get onto the other thing then. He mentions that we don't know the kid, so we don't care. And I think, actually, yeah, it would have been interesting if this had been, say, Fraz.
Yeah.
A known character. I realise why they didn't, and it's probably because we need the possibility that he might actually have stolen the money after all.
Exactly.
Which you think they wouldn't do for a regular character. But this sent me back to the press gang series treatment. You've heard me mention this a lot. At the end of series 1, I'm going to stick this PDF in the Facebook group for everyone to see, so they can see exactly what series 1 was meant to be. And, you know, what they can read about the nukes and the sets. And read about a character's story arc that is actually not happening. Oh, there you go. There is an episode in that treatment. It's called Where It Hurts, and it opens with the newsroom having been completely vandalised. This sends Linda into a fit of rage. Matt Kerr reminds her that newspapers are not in the revenge business. They're in the news business, and this is a story. He also reminds her that Norbridge is a national leader in juvenile violence and vandalism. And I'll tell you more about that at the end of Series 1 as well, because you may not have heard that mentioned thus far.
No, but I'm still waiting for that story based on Spike's school violence statistics.
Yes, that's the nearest we've been to there being any hint of sort of junior violence.
Crime problem.
Oh, no, there have been sort of some hints of Spike's old mates, if not necessarily a gang. But anyway, they check with the two gangs, the Nukes, who are back under the auspices of Spike, who's left the paper in previous episodes because of personal business, and the Sets, who are no longer answerable to Fraz. Both gangs plead innocence, and Linda's completely satisfied that Spike wouldn't lie to her, but it later comes out that Spike actually is solely responsible for the vandalism, and it was his initiation back into the gang. Which he later confesses directly to Linda, and that's a catalyst for him finally getting out of the gang once and for all and going full-time back on the paper. So, you're meant to spend that whole episode going, no, Spike wouldn't have done this, and only to have the shocker that it absolutely was him and him alone. So you could have done that with Fraz.
You could have.
But I think maybe it only works if he was found guilty at the end. If he wasn't found guilty, you go, well, of course, it's Fraz.
Yeah.
So maybe that is probably the best reasoning why it's someone we've never heard. I mean, we have lost Keith.
Yeah.
To the dark side. I wish I hadn't said that. And no, I'm sorry.
That's fine.
All right.
I understood exactly what you said.
Yeah, absolutely.
Indeed.
And so there you go. Right. We've got Illyria, are you ready to read an email from a German?
I think so, although have you read it already?
I haven't.
Can you read it, please? Because he mentions Buffy.
Oh. Oh,
and
I see.
I'm just concerned.
Hang on a second. Do-do-do-do-do. I think he's just talking about that he likes Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Okay.
And the thing I like about Buffy is you can never be sure what kind of episode you're going to... at a quick run, I'm going to say this is fine for you to read.
Awesome. We have an email from Fabian.
I meant to ask him about the pronunciation. I think it might be Fabian. But...
It might be Fabian. Fabian. Fabian Habestreit.
Yeah.
So, this weekend I read a badly researched listicle... in praise of my other favorite show, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and it said, quote, the mixture of drama and comedy is something that really emerged with Buffy, unquote. And it's obvious that the writer has never seen Press Gang. One of the myriad of things I like about Press Gang and Buffy is that you can never be sure what kind of episode you're going to get. Is it a dramatic article of the week-driven episode with a mystery at its center? Is it a screwball romance with Spike and Linda out Tracy and Hepburning each other? Or maybe it's a zany comedy involving one of Colin's schemes. Sometimes it's all three kinds of episodes in one.
Mm-hmm.
All of them vying for your attention, and then you have Money, Love, and Birdseed, a perfectly fine episode with a dull crime procedural plot at its center, which Moffat probably will recycle for Sherlock sometime soon, and I can't wait to see which future one-hit wonder Pretty Boy will then be cast as its villain.
Brilliant.
Spike and Linda are a lot... of fun as usual. I very consciously love their first scene and how it turns out to be just a dream, which is quintessential Moffat. I also love how Linda just bolts upright when she wakes up. It's normally just a completely unnatural cliche, but I have no trouble believing that it's normal for Linda Day to wake up that way. Other cute details were the concert tickets just sticking out of Spike's back pocket.
Yes.
And his impressive jump in their big Sam and Diane fight scene. I just wish that all of it could have happened organically, though, without Tiddler trying to play matchmaker for no reason at all, using a ploy that hinged on Spike and Linda never mentioning the word birthday. The way their fight broke out felt unorganically as well, as the flagpole story seemed more like something you'd write into a script as a placeholder until you came up with a reason to fight. I'm going to interrupt the email right now. Fabian, that is not just stuck in there. That is from the first episode, and it's fantastic. Back to the email. I was also surprised that apparently Linda's turn on is Spike quoting the Bible. But hey, whatever floats your boat, I guess. The birds were an amusing idea, but seeing them shitting all over the place and all over Colin just wasn't as much fun and inventive as finding pings everywhere.
Ping.
All in all, it's a perfectly fine, reasonably funny episode, which only bored me slightly in the overlong Sarah questions witnesses scene. But the point is, I have already watched the whole series several times, and yet I still couldn't remember one thing about this episode when I sat down to rewatch
it.
It's just not memorable, and so I give it only 3 10-pound notes. Greetings from Germany, where all those Nazi birds must have come from, Fab.
Oh, man. That is a heck of a sign-off. But, yeah.
Thank you, Fab.
But, yeah, as I mentioned earlier, it's never one that leaps directly into the mind. I did quite like it on this viewing, and what I do like about the Sarah questioning witnesses thing is how it leaps about through the different witnesses but continues to progress the story.
Yeah,
and I think it's very well done. Moffat learning how to do that. And of course the dreams business is all over coupling. Coupling barely takes place in anything like the real world.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Paul, are you happy to read our other email here?
Sure, I could do that.
Cool.
This one is from Mr. Brad Cubbles.
Of RamJackPodcast.com.
Of RamJackPodcast.com. This is the title of the email is Motherfucking Birdseed. That was the title, right? I'm pretty sure if you run it through the Foghorn Leghorn translator, that's what you get. This bird situation is nightmarish and unallowable. Burn that building to the ground. You cannot work in a cage of animal feces and disease. These kids need to unionize and go on strike immediately.
Yes. This is very Brad so far.
Yes, very much. I'm 80% sure this teacher/judo instructor is working an angle. If the reasons for having an accessible cash box is to make sure students have bus fare, why are there only 10-pound notes? Are you going to hope these children can make change? That's a terrible plan. I would not be surprised to learn he's filling the void and taking over the illicit solvent trade.
Nice.
And these three schmucks are straight up KD glue sniffers if I've ever seen some. Keep at it, gents, Brad.
Thanks, Brad.
Thank you, Brad.
I didn't think there was only £30 in the cash box. I was just like, but it is odd to have £10 notes in there at all, given given the stated reason for the cash
purpose.
Box. Yeah. But there you go, young writer, you know, having to come up with an episode, it's the best I could do you. Like, I just thought, he'll have to go, that'll do. So, yeah, it's weird. I keep going, I like it, and I didn't like it. But yeah. I think that's
I like it for my own very personal reasons, I think.
Yeah. That's all right. No, I'm glad. But it's exceptionally middling. So 3 out of 5, considering we don't do 0.5s, is as fair as you're going to get.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with various 3s and Matt's 1, it gives us sort of an upper 2.
Yeah, which is fine.
I'm okay with that. So
they can all be winners.
Right. Are you ready to tell me what happens next week once I give you the title?
I can't wait.
I can't wait for next week either. Next week is Monday, Tuesday. Paul, you are also free to guess.
Where?
If it helps, I think it'll be about the government boosting the economy by combining Monday and Tuesday into a single workday, wherein workers are expected to attend jobs on Monday morning and work constantly until Tuesday evening. Through a series of phone scams and sneaking into offices dressed in crazy costumes, the Junior Gazette get this practice overturned, leading directly to the UK recession of 1991.
Oh, directly.
Yep.
I'm going to predict this episode is about... it's hard. This is a very difficult title to predict.
It is.
Monday, Tuesday.
Happy days, Thursday, Friday. Okay. Happy days.
Here's my prediction. There is something that happened on Monday and Tuesday that nobody is directly referring to, and we only find out at the very end.
That's good.
So people keep referring to Monday and Tuesday, and they never really mention the details, and then we find out at the very, very end what the details were.
I like it. Any thoughts, Paul, or is it too oblique a title?
It seems very oblique to me. I don't really have a wacky offbeat prediction, though.
Right. Well, in that case, it's time, Paul, for you to pimp your podcasts.
All right. Well, first off, I've got 2 podcasts that are available at quadruplez.com, and those are a completed podcast called The Ghostlight Podcast. That's about the television series Slings and Arrows. It's about a theater company, and nice. It's highly recommended. And we also do the Idgitcast, which is an intro cast for the television series Supernatural. and we're just getting started on season 3 of that right now.
Nice. Now, quadruple Z, is it? It's the words quadruple, then Z or Z, right? It's not just the four. Because, yeah, I tried the four C's and I get to dnc.com and it seems like some kind of weird catcher for things.
Yes, no, quadruple Z is apparently an in-joke between Tabs and some of her other friends that I don't actually know the reference personally. She doesn't tell it.
Yeah, there's something very Hitchhiker's Guide about it, like ZZ9 plural Z alpha.
Alpha, yes.
But obviously that would be Zeds and that would be a different thing. But yeah, so I don't know where that's from. But in case anyone was looking for it and just typed 4Z/Zs and
yes.
Came up.
And then the other thing that I'm really excited about is the official return of the Geek by Night audio drama. It premieres on September 2nd of this year, and I've recorded for the first episode. It was very nice. I play the character Cosmo in this one.
Nice.
I was in the old version as well, but this is a brand new relaunch of the Geek by Night series. You can go to geekbynight.tumblr.com or duelinggenre.com.
That's awesome. I've never even really heard much about this. I'm just reading it now. That's excellent. I would have to read that later when I'm not doing a podcast.
That helps.
Right. Thank you for being on. Thank you for discussing that motherfucking birdseed with us.
Yes, indeed.
It's finger-licking good, you know.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Oh, you're very welcome. We
really appreciate you being on, Paul.
We like having guests. It's just that our timing doesn't tend to work with people very well.
Yes.
As you'll have seen. So we do appreciate you being up early for us.
Well, thank you.
All right. Illyrio, do you have any further words to say before I ask you for that last word?
Nope.
Well, in that case, Illyrio, give us the last word.
Aerosol.